Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk again a little bit about Maoist China and an aspect of Maoist Chinese economic history that's perhaps less well known than the five-year plans and the Great Leap Forward. This is one which was no less costly and arguably disastrous and a waste of resources. But it emerges for particular strategic reasons, and it helps us to look into Mao's thinking between the mid-1960s and his death in 1976. And it's a policy called the Third Front, which meant the militarization and industrialization of large parts of Western China. Now, traditionally, the most economically developed parts of China would have been Manchuria and the eastern seaboard. The development of industry and the development of colonialism in China went hand in hand from the self-strengthening movement onwards. You can go back and find the podcast I did on the self-strengthening movement some weeks ago. But the east and the north were particularly connected by railway networks, by steamboat networks, and by the development of telegraph and all the infrastructure of modernity. And during the Japanese occupation of Manchuria, it was colonized and developed economically, again in the most crude and exploitative manner by Japan. But that said, there was still a great deal of industrial infrastructure left behind at the end of the Second World War. The Third Front was a development of industry, particularly China's defence industries, a relocation of heavy industry, and an expansion of the railway network in Western China. And the reason behind this was Mao's obsessive paranoia about the Soviet Union and, to the southwest, the development of America's war in Vietnam. It was not entirely inconceivable in the eyes of Mao that America could attack China from Vietnam. And it was certainly far more likely, in Mao's Mao's perspective, that there could be a war with the USSR. And it seems that the chaos and the fear and the paranoia of the Cultural Revolution amplify foreign policy concerns in Mao's eyes. Now, the Third Front begins its development in 1964, so it slightly predates the beginnings of the Cultural Revolution in 1966, and it continues all the way through to 1980, 4 years after Mao's death. So it covers a time span far greater than the Great Leap Forward, and that helps to account for the massive amounts of resources that it seems that it manages to consume. The Third Front consumed, for example, a staggering 40% of all China's wealth, and 60% of all new railways built after 1964 were built in Western China. This was done by mainly labour-intensive methods, and the same kinds of labour-intensive methods that you see during the Great Leap Forward. And considering that the Great Leap Forward had only ended 2 years beforehand in the disaster of Mao's famine, some historians have suggested that the Third Front is simply a continuation of Great Leap policies. I'm not so sure about that myself, as it really the Third Front kind of comes from a very different place. If the Great Leap Forward was Mao's attempt to outshine the Soviet Union and to eclipse the West as quickly as possible and to demonstrate that his path to socialism, i.e. using mass peasant labour, was the trick. And it was a kind of a real display of Maoist arrogance. The Third Front, it comes from a far more anxious, far more fearful place. The relationship, perhaps, between the Great Leap Forward and the Third Front could be expressed as this. Once the Great Leap Forward had ended in disaster, China is far more vulnerable to the rising, or to the power of the Soviet Union, and the ability to demonstrate to the Soviet Union that China has a better route to socialism, a more robust basis in the Chinese peasantry, had been shown for the error that it was. And instead, a rapid militarization of this western flank between China and the Soviet Union was therefore essential. In terms of railway building alone, some of the conditions are fairly horrendous. So a lot of the building work had to go across mountainous terrain. And when workers were allocated to tiny peasant villages and towns that had barely enough resources to feed themselves, bear in mind we're still in a period where famine is a prevalent factor across much of China, the towns and villages were forced to put up men in barns, in grain silos, in whatever they could find. Some people ended up living in stables for a long period of time. A rice porridge congee was the staple for workers who lived by the railway lines and worked by day and often on night shift, and would have to move camp as the railway line grew. Many would grow vegetables along the route of the train tracks. It showed you how slowly the train tracks were put down and how slowly the railway network developed, if there was time to do that. And these vegetables would supplement the peasants' diets. A working day was 8 hours of hard physical labour, and they were paid far below the average labourer's wage. There was a culture in Maoist China of as much as you'd find often in the Soviet Union, slightly Stakhanovite kind of culture, of self-sacrifice, of voluntarism for a state-led, a state-directed society. Voluntarism it makes an interesting appearance within that kind of culture. And it was expected that Chinese workers would want to sacrifice, would want to work for wages far less than would consider the average, because they were building the future, building a Maoist future in China. And this should be almost ideologically reward in itself. So this self-denial was encouraged. Of course, Chinese peasants had almost no interest whatsoever in embracing yet further hardship in the interests of developing socialism. Instead, they were coerced into lower wages, and party cadres ensured that there was no opposition to this. Most meagre wages were received in kind. Peasants would receive a fifth of their wages in cash, and the rest would be accounted for in their daily expenses, such as their in inverted commas, accommodation and whatever food they consumed. The way in which work was managed on the railways was quite chaotic, to say the least. When deadlines loomed and sections of the track had not been completed, workers were forced and bullied into offering additional voluntary labour, working unpaid overtime. At the start of the project, there were some 660,000 members of the People's Liberation Army, or what was referred to as the Red Army Railway Corps. And this reflected another idea that was borrowed directly from the Soviet Union, which was the utilisation of soldiers as a labour army. This was originally a Trotskyite idea, that soldiers, once they completed active military service, could then be used for any kind of heavy labour, and this labour would be transformative. You can bring, say, for example, 500,000 men to a particular region to build dams and roads and that kind of thing. You have an industrialised modern economy before you know it, so the thinking goes. The Third Front has been seen largely as an economic failure. The resources that were pumped into it, and if you remember those stats from earlier on, if those had been applied to Eastern China, where there was existing industry, where there was existing infrastructure, then GDP in Eastern China would have dramatically increased and grown at a faster rate. There's often a reason why industries and infrastructure flourish in the places that they do. It is based around population centres, expertise, knowledge, skill, resources, and that kind of thing. And the fact that the Eastern Seaboard already had an advanced centres of economy meant that this was probably the place in which one should play to one's strengths. And if you look at post-Maoist China, again, it is this part of China that has really taken off during Deng Xiaoping's reforms and that sort of thing. However, Mao understood very little about economics. Mao had no time for it as a concept, really, and he was critical of characters like Liu Shaoqi and Deng Xiaoping when they considered the practicalities of economic development. He dismissed this very much and viewed this as a sideshow from his broader ideological visions. And Mao believed once again, as he had done during the Great Leap Forward, that by the mass...
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mobilization of the Chinese people all at one in one go, using ideological zeal as the inspirational force, that it would be possible to transform a vast region of China. Most of the railway lines were incomplete by 1973, and the reason why this is important is because at the height of Sino-Soviet tensions in the late 60s and early 70s, these railway lines would have been the means by which troops would have been taken to the front and other armaments as well. So the confusion and the chaos of the development of the Third Front would have had significant consequences had there actually been a war. There are border skirmishes in the late 60s, but the war that Mao anticipated with the Soviet Union, which led to the immensely fearful and paranoid anti-aircraft drills and the digging of bunkers in Beijing and all sorts of extraordinary actions and misreadings of Soviet intentions, this war never eventually comes. Now, here's an extract from Jonathan Fenby's Penguin History of Modern China, in which he describes the Third Front. A vast programme was rolled out in a supposedly safe mountainous region of Western China. 380 factories and their labour forces were moved inland from coastal areas. New enterprises were built, operating on a self-contained basis, cut off from towns and villages. As so often with Mao's sudden initiatives, everything had to be done at once. Planning was rudimentary and costs soared as a result. While projects fell further and further behind schedule and spread a severe economic damage. This Third Front almost doubled spending on construction between 1966 and 1970 to 894 million yuan, with expenditure in the southwest leaping to nearly a quarter of the total. The new development ate up huge amounts of coal, power and steel. Pursuing this and all-out civil war, the Cultural Revolution, simultaneously, while keeping the general economy running and the country under some form of overall government, was beyond the bounds of fantasy. I think the interesting thing that Jonathan Fenby picks out there is the idea of sudden initiatives, that everything that Mao had launched in China, every major initiative that had inevitably become some kind of grand catastrophe, such as the Great Leap Forward or the Third Front, had been cooked up in semi-secret, had been launched on the party and then on the nation in a short space of time. Normally Mao would announce a new initiative or hint that some kind of change was coming by writing in the People's Daily or in other party newspapers. And then there would be an immense flurry of activity of people attempting to interpret what Mao meant and whether it had implications for them. A lot of it would be said in various aphorisms and euphemisms and subtexts and that kind of thing. And he was deliberately cryptic to keep his opponents, his enemies in the party, on the back foot. And so much of the ability of party bureaucrats to plan ahead and to interpret Mao's wishes effectively and to interpret new economic initiatives in a way that would have a minimum impact on the population and maximise economic and strategic goals. Much of this was massively hamstrung. You have to bear in mind as well that China's experts, the intelligentsia, much of the university departments, China's academia, engineers, architects, designers, planners, had been purged during the 100 Flowers campaign. Now, I talked about the 100 Flowers a long, long time ago, maybe it was last year, perhaps even the year before, but you can find it on this podcast if you search for it. Mao lured the intelligentsia of China into open criticism of the party. Then when the criticism reached levels that he was uncomfortable with and it was more personally directed at him, he purged them. The difficulty with this for China is that any group that was likely to place a brake on Mao's ambitions to be the devil's advocate to suggest that what he was saying was unworkable had now been swept away. And a leader that is immersed in their own hubris, their own arrogance, and has throttled all voices of dissent is normally in very dangerous company, i.e. their own. The moving of factories inland had been directly modelled on Stalin's moving of Soviet factories away from the Nazi war machine in the first part of the Operation Barbarossa. Mao was a great admirer of this particular feat. There was scant regard for the industrial workers either. Now, previously in this podcast, we talked about how the peasants were used for their labour and treated extremely badly. The industrial workers had a similar experience. Frank Dakota writes, at Panjihua, a forbidding barren region with large mineral resources in the south of Sichuan, a huge iron and steel complex emerged after 1965. Tens of thousands of construction workers were sent from all over the country to dig coal mines, lay rail tracks and build power plants. The railway alone, tunnelling through hundreds of kilometres from the new steel city to both Chengdu and Kunming, cost 3.3 billion yuan. One member of the youth corps that was part of the first contingent to move to Panjihua in 1965 said, "We didn't have anything, not even coal to cook with, and the hills were covered only in scrub brush that was hardly fit for burning. We wandered around with just one set of clothes, a wide-brimmed hat to protect us from the sun, and a canteen. As for transportation, we had nothing but our own 2 feet. But no amount of hardship could stand in the way of the Third Front. The impatient chairman told the Ministry of Mining and Industry that, 'I cannot sleep until we build the Panjihua iron and steel mill. Concerned about the lack of capital, he donated the royalties of the Little Red Book and his other writings to the cause. Now, the Third Front was not as catastrophic as the Great Leap Forward, inasmuch as it didn't create a famine that killed 40 million people. But it was a vast misallocation of resources on a roughly similar scale. And the fact that a similar famine didn't repeat itself is perhaps merely good fortune on the regime's part. The disruption of the Cultural Revolution brought much of the work to a halt, as it did across China. And as you've heard from the previous segment from Frank Dakota and his The Cultural Revolution, People's History, 1962-76, there was scant little regard for organisation and planning to ensure that the impact on people, on workers and on peasants was limited and manageable. And the local people in the regions that the workers and peasants had been shipped to also had to put up with and deal with this vast increase in populations, given very little support by the state in order to do this. One only has to have a look at contemporary refugee crises in the Middle East and Europe to see what mass migration looks like, and unplanned mass migration as well. This was planned mass migration, but without any state intervention to ameliorate any of the side effects. In small towns across China, vast queues for food, sanitation, water, clothing and shelter emerged. And it was this combined with almost no planning and the fact that everything was done in a climate of panic and fear that was generated by the Cultural Revolution itself that was going on around the workers, and also this sense that the Soviet Union and perhaps even America based in Vietnam were close to spelling doom for Maoist China. And this resulted in a significant overrunning of all projects. All projects were by and large badly planned, cost far more than they were budgeted for. Often projects, factories, towns, railway lines, lay incomplete for long periods of time. And this led to an immense squandering and wasting of resources. Pan Zhihua managed to first start smelting steel by 1970. Another mill in Zhuiquan in Gansu province was, its design was changed six times, and eventually it took 27 years for it to start producing steel. So the kind of takeaway point from all of this is that this was, in the 20th century, one of the biggest allocations or misallocations of state resources of all time. It is an economic failure, second only to the Great Leap Forward. And the only distinguishing feature, really, is the fact it wasn't accompanied by mass famine. Now, I hope you found that useful and informative and interesting. If so, and you'd like to support us on Patreon, there will be a link in this podcast to our Patreon page. Also, if you can give us a good review on iTunes, that would be greatly appreciated. It's a much more cost-effective way than forking out for Patreon. So get over to iTunes, give us a good rating, give us a nice write-up, and we'll be much obliged. We'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. I'm really, really glad that you're here listening to us and part of the growing audience, and we'll speak to you soon. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.